content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 13th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump completes his GOP takeover. What happened? Capping one of the most astonishing stories in modern political history, Donald Trump became the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party this week after a crushing victory in Indiana forced his only remaining rivals, Senator Ted Cruz and Ohio Governor John Kasich, to exit the race. The billionaire businessman picked up 53% of the vote and all of the available delegates in the Hoosier state primary, which his opponent saw as their last opportunity to deny him the nomination. Trump, who trails likely Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton by double digits in most national polls, called his victory a beautiful thing to behold and asked Republicans to unite behind him. Cruz said his campaign gave it everything we've got, but conceded that voters chose another path. Republicans now face the dilemma of whether or not to support Trump, a highly polarizing candidate who many believe will cause irreparable damage to the party's brand. Rince Priebus, the Republican National Committee chairman, said, "Something new is probably good for our party," and urged members to unite and focus on defeating Hillary Clinton. But some prominent conservatives, including Senators Ben Sasse of Nebraska and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and former RedState.com editor Eric Erickson, doubled down on their opposition to the frontrunner. "We will get destroyed, and we will deserve it," said Graham. Cruz declined to say whether he'd endorse Trump. When the frontrunner repeated a fabricated tabloid report tying Cruz's father to the JFK assassinations on the day of the Indiana primary, the Texas senator denounced his opponent as a narcissist, a serial philanderer, and a pathological liar. What the editorial said: "It's Donald Trump's party now," said the New York Times. "Republicans are about to nominate the most volatile and least prepared presidential candidate in modern times, a demagogue who offers nothing but xenophobia, isolationism, and vague, empty promises to make America great again. Party leaders have only themselves to blame. For years, they've focused on rewarding their wealthy donors while doing nothing for middle-class people who lost their homes, jobs, and savings to the recession and went dutifully off to Middle East wars. Trump's victory shows how angry voters are over their betrayal. Someday, everyone in the GOP will have to account for his or her behavior during Trump's run for the White House," said the Washington Post. "His anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim rhetoric, his disdain for facts, and his willful ignorance of policy make Trump the most repugnant political phenomenon in recent American history. Yet some Republicans are already caving in. Those who head to the moral poorhouse won't be forgotten or easily forgiven. Some conservatives are floating the idea of running a third-party candidate as a protest against Trump," said the Wall Street Journal. "They argue that a true conservative on the ballot would motivate GOP voters who might otherwise stay home in November and help keep the Senate and House in Republican hands. That thought is tempting, but the likelihood is that it would serve only to divide Republican voters and guarantee Clinton's victory. Trump must now either behave in a way that reduces his epic unfavorable numbers or own his defeat." What the columnist said: "The Republican establishment deserve to lose, said Scott McConnell in the AmericanConservative.com. The white working class has experienced a massive sociological decline in wages, life chance, and life expectancy. Yet the GOP's leaders have done nothing to help them. Trump simply recognized that this group was being neglected and dismissed by Washington and promised to fight for them. Though many Republicans are not happy with their de facto nominee, they'll eventually rally behind him, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. By November, Trump will probably be supported by more than 80% of Republican voters as he battles the hated Hillary. Republican senators and congressmen won't buck their constituents out of fear of losing their jobs, so backing Trump will become the rational thing to do. Trump is an extinction-level event, said Andrew Sullivan in New York Magazine. The firewalls that used to stop demagogues rising to power in American politics, the closed primary systems, and the elite's control of media coverage have fallen. Now there is a real danger that a fascist will end up in the White House, propelled there by his demonization of foreigners and minorities and his authoritarian embrace of violence and rage. Those insisting that Trump cannot win in November are kidding themselves. Polling has consistently undervalued this cult leader's popularity. He has a strong, simple message, and he is facing a deeply flawed opponent. Trump won't win because Democrats enjoy a strong electoral college advantage, said Sean Illing in Salon.com. If Clinton wins the 19 true blue states that have voted Democratic in the past six elections, she'll already have 242 of the 270 electoral college votes that she needs to become the 45th president. A win in Florida, where polls show her 13 points ahead of Trump, would push her over the line, even if she loses every one of the Rust Belt swing states. The simple reality is that as Republican voters grow older, wider, and more extreme, the party ceases to be competitive in presidential elections. Our controversy of the week, Obama, how will history judge his economic legacy? When President Obama took office in 2008, said Andrew Ross Sorkin in the New York Times Magazine, the global economy was in free fall. A full-blown financial crisis, the worst since the Great Depression, had left several major U.S. banks close to defaulting, housing prices plummeting, rattled employers shedding 800,000 jobs a month, and a deep recession gripping the country. 8 years later, unemployment has been cut in half to 5%. The annual budget deficit has been reduced by nearly $1 trillion. And the private sector has added 14 million jobs over the longest sustained period of job growth in U.S. history. So why is it, then, that the economy is terrible has become the narrative of the 2016 campaign? The answer, President Obama told me in an extended interview, lies in his failure to communicate his economic successes to the American people. We were moving so fast early on that we couldn't take victory laps, Obama said. I mean, one day we're saving the banks, the next day we're saving the auto industry. Despite the GOP's relentlessly pessimistic messaging, Obama says, we probably managed this better than any large economy on earth. Sure, the headline numbers look great, says Charles Gasparino in the New York Post. But dig deeper and you'll find trouble. Unemployment has dropped partly because a huge number of people have given up looking for jobs, the labor participation rate dropping to a 38-year low. Household income for the average American family, meanwhile, is still $4,000 lower than when Bill Clinton left office. This has been the weakest recovery in the post-war era, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. We've had puny 1 to 2% growth for years now, and just 0.5% in the first quarter this year. That's a direct result of Obamanomics, blowout government spending, higher taxes, and ever-tightening regulation. Faster growth will require pro-growth supply-side policies. Yes, GDP growth could be stronger, said Albert Hunt in BloombergView.com. But is there any country whose hand you would rather have? No Western country has experienced faster growth than the U.S. since 2008. Even in Germany, inflation-adjusted GDP is up 6% since 2007, compared with our 10%. Try telling that to American workers who haven't seen a raise in 15 years, said David Dayan in NewRepublic.com. They don't grade themselves against people in Europe or China. They look at their own lives and decide whether or not they've improved. America's economy may have bounced back, but because most of the wealth created after the recession has gone to the top 10%, we haven't all felt that recovery. Truth is, Obama inherited two distinct sets of economic problems when he took office, said Ben Castleman in 538.com. One was caused by the financial crisis itself. The second involved deeper structural problems that began years or even decades before the recession, including wage stagnation and the decline of manufacturing and the failure to find a new source of middle-class jobs to replace it. Automation and globalization created these problems, which were probably beyond any president's ability to solve. But they are a big part of why voters are angry about the economy, despite so much short-term progress, and why populist candidates Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump have been so successful in the 2016 campaign. Obama does deserve credit for staving off catastrophe, said Michael Parlberg in TheGuardian.com. But if he's concerned about his legacy, he might look for a more compelling one than "it could have been worse." It was a good week for diversity. After a new Indiana University study estimated that Earth is home to 1 trillion species of organisms, of which 99.99% have yet to be discovered. Most are microbes. It was a good week for first world problems after an Illinois woman sued Starbucks, saying the chain is underfilling its cold coffee beverages by putting in too much ice. Our customers understand and expect that ice is an essential component of any iced beverage, a Starbucks spokesperson responded. And it was a good week for lasting impressions after the U.S. Navy lifted its decades-old restriction on visible tattoos in a bid to recruit more millennials. Will we get new recruits that wouldn't have previously applied to the Navy? I think absolutely yes, said a Navy spokesman. But it was a bad week for extinction events. After the Large Hadron Collider, a 17-mile European superconductor that smashes protons together at nearly the speed of light, was knocked offline for a week when a small furry mammal gnawed through a power cable and was incinerated. It was a bad week for sticker shock after a British motorist crashed his brand new McLaren 650S into a tree just 10 minutes after purchasing the $310,000 sports car. The 641-horsepower car reaches 60 miles per hour in less than 3 seconds. And it was a bad week for Ted Cruz, who not only was forced from the GOP presidential primaries, but endured a week in which he called an Indiana-based basketball hoop a ring, failed to notice when running mate Carly Fiorina tumbled off a stage and elbowed his distraught wife Heidi in the face as he turned to give her a consoling hug. Our briefing page article is titled this week, Chicago in Crisis. The city of the Big Shoulders is buckling under the weight of major racial, political, and economic burdens. What's wrong with Chicago? For all its wonders, arts, jazz, classic architecture, a thriving restaurant scene, deep dish pizza, the nation's third largest city is riddled with dysfunction. Chicago is a physical basket case, says urban analyst Aaron Wren, with a lower credit rating than any major metropolis except Detroit. The city's 6.6% jobless rate ranks 51st, dead last, among metropolitan areas with more than 1 million residents. Its strapped school system seems perpetually on the verge of collapse, and last month teachers staged a one-day strike to protest closings and budget cuts. Chicago routinely ranks among the nation's most politically corrupt cities, with a Democratic machine controlling City Hall for 90 years. That machine has incurred $20 billion in unfunded pension debt by giving generous public pensions to unions. But above all, what's tearing at the city's heart are crime, police brutality, and violence. Why is the city so violent? Extreme poverty and drugs have left the city's south side in control of warring gangs, who have filled the streets with gunfire. Violent crime is at the highest level in decades, with more than 1,000 people shot so far this year. In the first quarter of 2016, police say 141 people were killed, compared with 82 during the same period in 2015. And last year's total of 470 made Chicago America's murder capital. Meanwhile, police are under intense scrutiny for their aggressive tactics after the release of a long-suppressed video showing the 2014 death of 17-year-old African-American Laquan McDonald. Armed with only a knife, McDonald was shot 16 times, 14 of them while lying in the street, by white officer Jason Van Dyke. Police covered up the shooting for a year until they were forced to release the video. Van Dyke was then charged with murder. Massive protest led to the resignation of Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy and forced embattled Mayor Rahm Emanuel to form a Police Accountability Task Force, which filed a blistering report. What did the report say? The task force said the police were guilty of decades of racism and had a long, sad history of death, false imprisonment, physical and verbal abuse. Cops who brutalized black citizens, the report said, rarely faced consequences. In response to the report and new frisking rules, Chicago cops have pulled back on making stops. Perhaps too far. Officers are just having second thoughts about being aggressive, says Loyola University criminal justice professor Robert Lombardo. Indeed, through the first 3 months of 2016, police have stopped, frisked, or questioned 20,908 people, compared with 157,346 in the first quarter of last year. Why is the economy suffering? Deindustrialization, the Great Recession, and other economic forces eliminated 7% of Chicago's jobs between 2000 and 2010, a higher share than in any other of the nation's 10 largest metro areas. Chicago has no marquee industry to help drive its economy, unlike New York, finance, Los Angeles, entertainment, and Washington, D.C., government. Its wealth was built by dominating America's agro-industrial complex, Wren says, railroads, meatpacking, lumber processing, and grain processing. But that is long gone. That loss has only deepened the city's entrenched poverty and racial divisions. Chicago is experiencing a steep decline, quite different from that of many other large cities, Wren says. It's a deeply troubled place. Are its racial divisions unusual? Chicago ranks as one of the most racially and economically segregated metropolitan areas in the U.S. The affluent North Side and neighborhoods west of downtown are overwhelmingly white, while African Americans and Latinos cluster on the low-income South and far West sides. Whites, who represent 42% of the population, saw their household incomes rise 33% between 1990 and 2012, while blacks experienced a 4% decline. The African American poverty rate, 33.6%, and unemployment rate, 14.7%, are more than twice those of whites. A recent report found that 47% of black men in Chicago between 20 and 24 were out of both school and work in 2014, 15% higher than the national average. The situation, says Great Cities Institute Director Teresa Cordova, is definitely at crisis proportions. Does Chicago have hope? There are bright spots. Companies including Kraft and Motorola have helped revitalize the downtown Loop Business District, and tourism booms. Last month, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and other philanthropies launched Benefit Chicago, a $100 million initiative to help nonprofits promote affordable housing and job training. But as for Chicago's most high-profile crisis, it remains to be seen whether Emanuel's task force can improve police-community relations. Among the recommendations are a civilian police review board, more body cameras, mental health training for officers, and programs addressing systemic racism and poverty. It all sounds wonderful, but putting this plan into action is going to take years and years, said Jeffrey Coleman, whose mentally ill brother died after repeated police tasering in 2012. We need to make sure the changes are made after the fire goes out and the public's interest dies down. Emanuel's precipitous fall. When he was elected mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel was a political superstar. Last year, the pugnacious former White House chief of staff was reelected mayor with 56% of the vote. Now a majority of Chicagoans think he should resign, and he is fighting for his political survival. What happened? So many scandals, says local historian Rick Perstein. It's hard to single them out. His transit system smart card failed miserably and was rife with hidden fees. A charter school advocate, Emanuel angered parents and teachers by closing 49 public schools, many in black neighborhoods. His school CEO, Barbara Bird Bennett, resigned over a kickback scheme. But what really sank Emanuel was the McDonald video, which many believe he suppressed to protect his reelection. Still, some believe forcing Emanuel to quit would do little to solve Chicago's problems. If Rahm were to resign, said Representative Bobby Rush, Democrat from Illinois, a longtime black community leader, Chicago would only move from one chaos to another chaos. Moving on to the columns now, we'll take one from the U.S. this week. It's still a crime in 21 states. Why is adultery still a crime, asks Deborah Rode. Believe it or not, cheating on your spouse remains illegal in 21 states. In Wisconsin and Oklahoma, it's a felony. These laws are rarely enforced. If they were, Donald Trump might not have boasted about his serial philandering. But the fact that adultery is still a crime enables employers and the government to punish people for it. Courts have permitted dismissals or discipline of police officers, librarians, fire department employees, and FBI trainees based on marital infidelity that had no demonstrable connection to their job performance. In states that have repealed adultery laws, there has been no resulting epidemic of cheating. Indeed, research today shows that about 20% of married men and 15% of married women admit to having been unfaithful, substantially lower rates than in the 1950s. Legal scholar Thurmond Arnold once made this cogent observation about unenforced laws. They are unenforced because we want to continue our conduct, and unrepealed because we want to preserve our morals. Let's stop playing that hypocritical game and get those anachronistic and intrusive laws off the books. From Turkey, we will not become a religious state. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has just been forced to promise that he won't impose Sharia law on Turkey, said Semih İdiz. Secular Turks have long been suspicious of the motives of Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, which has its roots in Islamism. Then last week, the party's Speaker of the National Assembly, İsmail Kamaran, made the gaffe of saying out loud that the new constitution under discussion should be stripped of all references to secularism and be based on religious values instead. When you combine that with his support of Erdogan's push to change Turkey's parliamentary system into a presidential one, Kahraman appears to be calling for the creation of an Islamic dictatorship governed by Sharia. Erdogan himself has always been careful to couch his opposition to secularism based on what he calls the undemocratic manner in which it was imposed by Turkish founding father Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. But now that Kahraman has spoken so plainly, the increasingly authoritarian Erdogan can no longer dance around the subject. Faced with an uproar in parliament and across the country, he has now agreed that the new Turkish constitution will retain its secularist foundation. Turks should perhaps thank Kahraman for forgetting his talking points and exposing Erdogan's true agenda while it could still be stopped. And a How They See Us column. Fury over confiscated Iranian cash. America just brazenly stole $2 billion from Iran, said Namat Ahmadi. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled last month that nearly $2 billion in frozen Iranian central bank assets must be turned over to survivors and relatives of Americans killed in terrorist attacks that the U.S. blames on Iran. Those attacks include the 1983 truck bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, which killed 241 American servicemen, and the 1996 truck bombing of the Khobar Towers complex in Saudi Arabia. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calls the asset seizure an outrageous robbery and a travesty of justice, and he is right. Even by U.S. legal standards, the ruling is outrageous. Iran had been winning a long-running legal battle against those trying to confiscate its assets when Congress passed a law in 2012 that authorized the seizure and distribution of $2 billion in Iranian-owned bonds held in a New York bank. It was a clear violation of the separation of powers that forbids the legislature from intervening in legal cases. Now the Supreme Court has affirmed that overreach. This is nothing less than an act of aggression. We had the nuclear agreement to blame for this humiliation, said Mohammad Safari. Our reformist president, Hassan Rouhani, naively believed that he was entering a new era of cooperation with the U.S. when he clinched a deal earlier this year that curtailed Iran's nuclear program in exchange for the easing of international sanctions. Yet the Americans' policy of enmity has only intensified since then. There is no evidence tying Iran to the Beirut and Khobar explosions, but the Obama administration and its Supreme Court lackeys have decided to punish us anyway. America is sending out the message that after crippling our nuclear capabilities, it can now do whatever it wants against Iran. They want to loot our property, says Kayan in an editorial. Fine, we can confiscate theirs. Iran has ample legal standing to take U.S. assets. After all, they froze our foreign funds at the start of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, when citizens stormed the U.S. embassy and took 52 Americans hostage. And they broke their promise to return all the money after the hostages were released. It's time to even the score. Let's start seizing American merchant ships in the Persian Gulf. The operation wouldn't be difficult. It only requires determination. But such a display of aggression would squander our advantage, said Mohammed Kazemi. Right now, the world is on our side. Many other countries, especially China and Russia, must be worried that the U.S. will eventually try to loot their assets if this American street robbery goes unpunished. If we join forces and launch a comprehensive diplomatic attack, we can put extensive political pressure on the U.S. ruling system and reverse this act of financial piracy. And our in-depth article, The Last Word, titled this week, Cleaning Up Fukushima. 5 years ago, a magnitude 9.0 earthquake and tsunami caused the worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. Writer Steve Featherstone investigates just how much decontamination work Japan's Fukushima still requires. A 50-foot wall of water spawned by the quake exploded over Daiichi's seawall, swamping backup diesel generators. Four of six nuclear reactors on site experienced a total blackout. Three of them melted down, spewing enormous amounts of radiation into the air and sea in what became the worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl in 1986. The Japanese government never considered abandoning Fukushima, as the Soviet Union did with Chernobyl. It made the unprecedented decision to clean up the contaminated areas, in the process generating a projected 22 million cubic meters of low-level radioactive waste, and returned some 80,000 nuclear refugees to their homes. This past September, the first of 11 towns in Fukushima's mandatory evacuation zone reopened after extensive decontamination, but fewer than 2% of evacuees returned that month. More will follow, but surveys indicate that the majority didn't want to go back. While the Japanese government rebuilds Fukushima Prefecture, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, is slowly dismantling the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, a process that's expected to cost at least $15 billion. On a recent tour of the site, several other journalists and I were taken to a building where TEPCO has a special viewing room outfitted with thick, radiation-proof portholes. Carved from a 115-foot-high coastal bluff in the late 1960s, the Fukushima Daiichi complex has two main terraces separated by a steep slope. From my vantage point, 7 stories above the upper terrace, I could see the entire 860-acre site, a bustling city of 7,000 workers garbed in white Tyvek suits. Before the disaster, much of the plant's grounds were covered in pine trees that served as a bird sanctuary. At Fukushima Daiichi, there's no textbook, said the chief decommissioning officer, Naohiro Masuda, when I spoke to him at TEPCO's headquarters. There are 3 reactors, and each has a different manner in which the fuel melted. So we need to think of 3 different methods to solve this problem. In other words, Fukushima Daiichi has 3 separate decommissioning projects, not just one. A reactor like those at Fukushima Daiichi is essentially a sophisticated machine for boiling water. Fission heat from nuclear fuel rods makes steam that spins a turbine, producing electricity. The steam is condensed, cooled, and pumped back into the reactor core to keep the fuel from overheating and to make more steam. If water circulation stops, the rods can get so hot that they begin to lose integrity. In a worst-case scenario, they melt like wax candles, and the molten fuel pools up inside the reactor, releasing massive amounts of radiation. Masuda estimates that decommissioning the Fukushima Daiichi site, removing all nuclear and radiological hazards, will take 3 to 4 decades. Although he acknowledged that the technologies required to scoop melted fuel out of the damaged reactors don't even exist yet. Engineers are studying the problem, he says, but we don't think there's no way to remove the fuel. There's huge risk involved. If you make one small mistake, it might cause a huge problem for the local people or even worldwide. To get a closer look at the reactors, the other journalists and I donned anti-contamination gear. Safety helmet, dust mask, goggles, 2 pairs of latex gloves, 1 pair of cotton gloves, long-sleeved undershirt with breast pockets to hold a dosimeter, a device the size of a flip phone that measures the amount of radiation a person absorbs, disposable pants, 2 pairs of socks, Tyvek suit, rubber boots, disposable boot covers, and masking tape to seal the shirt cuffs. All of these precautions were supposed to keep radioactive contaminants from getting inside our lungs and on our skin. A TEPCO handout informed us that our dust dosimeters were set to beep in 20 microserves intervals. Properly clothed, we clambered aboard a bus, upholstered in thick plastic and duct tape. Once landscaped with greenery, the long, steep slope separating the upper and lower terrace of Fukushima Daiichi is now a moonscape of smooth concrete, designed to keep the rainwater from soaking into the contaminated ground. As the bus descended toward the ocean, we passed an area piled high with the trunks of dead pine trees. I could see the roofs of the 4 damaged reactors. They were 19 stories tall, except for Unit 3, shortened by a hydrogen explosion that blew its top off. Cranes used to erect new reactor coverings that prevent the spread of radioactive dust dangled above them. Even under ordinary conditions, retrieving fuel rods from a nuclear reactor's core is a delicate procedure requiring the use of specialized machinery. The fuel rods are sealed inside a reactor pressure vessel, an RPV, a 750-ton steel capsule filled with water lodged in the heart of the reactor. Surrounding the RPV is the primary contaminant vessel, PCV, a massive pear-shaped structure made of concrete up to 5 feet thick and lined with 5 inches of steel. The PCV, in turn, is embedded in a concrete honeycomb of utility rooms filled with a labyrinth of pipes, pumps, and other equipment. The only part of the reactor visible to the eye is a thin outer layer of sheet metal and concrete. We boarded the bus and motored down a road at the base of the reactors. Units 1, 3, and 4 had suffered hydrogen explosions that looked dramatic in news footage. In reality, the explosions blew apart only the reactor's thin outer layers, leaving the massive PCVs mostly intact. At least that's the hope. Nobody can say for certain if the earthquake, hydrogen explosions, or some unknown event, a mysterious explosion was heard from coming from deep inside Unit 2, for instance, cracked the PCVs. Fatal radiation levels make it impossible to send inspection crews inside the reactors. Instead, TEPCO sent 2 robots into Unit 1 this past April to locate the melted fuel. One robot stopped working within 3 hours. The other persevered for 4 days. The best data TEPCO has received about the location of fuel debris came from a recent Muon scan of Unit 1. The scan revealed a void inside the reactor pressure vessel, confirming the worst-case scenario. Molten fuel had burned clean through and slumped to the bottom of the PCV. Fuel probably melted through the RPVs in units 2 and 3 as well. The likelihood of TEPCO meeting its 2021 deadline for the start of fuel removal is, at best, remote. My dosimeter beeped its first 20 alert as the bus passed the common pool building, where thousands of spent nuclear fuel assemblies sit submerged underwater. The bus braked in front of Unit 4, and we got out to look at what TEPCO calls the Seaside Impermeable Wall, 594 concrete and steel piles that run almost half a mile along the waterfront. It's the last line of defense between Fukushima Daiichi and the sea, though it is designed to protect the sea from the nuclear plant, not vice versa. To understand the scale of the water problem at Fukushima Daiichi, you have to go back to the disaster's early days. Under normal conditions, water circulates through the reactors in a closed loop to cool the nuclear fuel and generate steam. That loop broke during the disaster, and TEPCO resorted to pouring seawater into the overheating reactors. The reactors and turbine buildings quickly began filling up with thousands of tons of highly contaminated seawater. A few more days and water would have overflowed the plant, which would have taken whatever they had and squared it in terms of a catastrophe, recalls John Raymount, founder of Curion, a nuclear waste management company based in Irvine, California. We heard that some of the men at the site would step in a puddle of and get radiation burns immediately from it. There are no longer skin-searing puddles of radioactive water, but TEPCO is still circulating 300 metric tons of water per day into the reactors to keep the melted fuel cool. An ad hoc circulation loop pumps contaminated water from the reactors to a purification system that removes two of the worst radionuclides, cesium and strontium. Most of the water then goes back into the reactors or is piped to a tank farm. There are 1,000 tanks at the Fukushima Daiichi containing more than 700,000 metric tons of contaminated water, equivalent to nearly 300 Olympic-sized swimming pools. TEPCO can't go on building tanks forever, nor can it discharge water into the ocean. The water is contaminated with high levels of tritium, a radioisotope that can't be removed using conventional filtration technology. Even if TEPCO could eliminate the tritium overnight, it's doubtful the government would allow the company to dump 1 million tons of purified Fukushima water into the ocean before the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. In the meantime, water tanks are sprouting up all over the site like toadstools after a rainstorm. We boarded the bus and headed toward reactor units 5 and 6. Located on high ground, the units were untouched by the tsunami, but they lay directly in the path of the radioactive plume that ended up contaminating 3,500 square miles of land northwest of the plant. We passed dead pine trees scattered like toothpicks. For the second and last time, my dosimeter beeped the 20 alert. In 2 hours on site, most of it riding on the bus, I'd received a radiation dose equivalent to at least 4 chest x-rays. The Fukushima disaster had a chilling effect on the nuclear power industry worldwide. Germany is phasing out of nuclear energy altogether. China suspended its rapidly expanding program. And in Japan, where nuclear power supplied 30% of the country's energy, the entire reactor fleet was taken offline. But the nuclear chill has begun to warm up lately. 10 new reactors went online last year, the most since 1990. China now has 24 reactors under construction, with more on the books. Last August, Japan quietly restarted its first reactor since the disaster. Ikuro Anzai, an owlish 75-year-old nuclear scientist from Kyoto, is skeptical of this development. He's spent his career criticizing the incestuous relationship between government regulators and the nuclear industry. He travels to Fukushima Prefecture every month to measure radiation levels to reassure those who no longer trust the government. On a drizzly afternoon, I met Anzai at the Torikawa Nursery School in Fukushima City, about 40 miles from Fukushima Daiichi. Residents there were never evacuated, although radioactive hot spots in parts of town still exceed the government's decontamination goal of 0.23. Anzai knelt next to a swing set and held a gamma spectrometer over a hole in the sand. 0.07 microsieverts per hour, he announced. It's the same as my office in Kyoto. That was less than half the radiation levels Anzai found when he surveyed the same area 2 years ago. Good news for the children who attend Torikaya Nursery School. Ever since the disaster, they've been cooped up for fear they'd be exposed to radiation. Now they could take their daily walk again. We still worry about the food, the director of the nursery school, Miyoko Sato, told me. Food grown with Fukushima Prefecture, famous for its produce in Japan, is closely monitored for radioactive contamination. But the school still sources its food from outside it. As the decommissioning of the nuclear plant moves forward, Anzai has one simple piece of advice for Japan's government and its nuclear industry. Don't hide, don't lie, and don't underestimate. In many ways, rebuilding Fukushima Prefecture is the easy part. Japan has recovered from far worse. Restoring public faith will be much more difficult because trust has no half-life. On the Health and Science page, the giant coral reef that shouldn't exist. Most of the world's reefs are confined to crystal clear tropical waters where corals that rely on photosynthetic algae are drenched in sunlight. But scientists have discovered a startling exception to this rule. A 600-mile-long, undetected coral reef in the dark, muddy waters off Brazil's northern coast, where the sediment-rich Amazon River flows into the Atlantic Ocean. We found a reef where the textbooks say there shouldn't be one, the study's co-author Fabiano Thompson tells National Geographic. The mouth of the Amazon, which is deprived of light and oxygen and is dark brown with silt, was the last place scientists expected to find a vibrant reef system. Chasing scattered reports hinting at the reef's existence, however, researchers in Brazil dredged small areas of the seafloor and found 61 species of sponge, including one weighing hundreds of pounds, 73 types of fish, 35 species of algae, 26 soft corals, and 12 stony corals. We brought up the most amazing animals I've ever seen on an expedition like this, says University of Georgia researcher Patricia Yeager. The reef, which spans 3,700 square miles along South America's continental shelf, also is home to unique microbes that apparently base their metabolism on minerals and chemicals like ammonia and nitrogen, not sunlight. Exploration of the Brazilian reef has only just begun, but scientists say it would appear to be a unique ecosystem. The health scare of the week, spanking backfires. A majority of American parents still believe spanking is an effective way to discipline children. But a new study has found physical discipline actually makes children more defiant and more likely to have later alcohol, drug, and mental health problems. After examining the findings of 75 children involving more than 160,000 children, a team of researchers from the University of Texas and the University of Michigan found that the children who are routinely disciplined with an open-handed smack on the bottom, a spanking, have behavior problems similar to those of children who are physically abused. In fact, the more kids are spanked, the more likely they are to develop low self-esteem and become aggressive, antisocial, and rebellious, the meta-analysis reveals. Spanking does the opposite of what parents usually want it to do, the study's co-author Andrew Grogan-Kaler tells NBCNews.com. The researchers suggest that parents use non-physical forms of discipline and rely on positive reinforcement of desirable behavior, which research shows is far more effective than punishment. On the Talking Points page, Trump versus Clinton, the looming gender war. When Republican leaders declared after losing the last presidential election that the party had to do more to attract female voters, said Kathleen Decker in LATimes.com, this was not what they had in mind. Last week, GOP frontrunner Donald Trump claimed that his Democratic rival Hillary Clinton, a former twice-elected senator and secretary of state, had dominated the Democratic race by playing the woman's card. Trump, who has never held public office in his life, doubled down by saying that if Hillary Clinton were a man, I don't think she'd get 5% of the vote. Even for Trump, that's a curious electoral strategy, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com. He's now put women in the same category as Hispanics, blacks, Muslims, and other groups who enjoy unfair advantages over white males in our society. Maybe some men will agree, but more than 70% of women already have strongly unfavorable views of Trump, and women will cast a majority of votes in November. Ah, yes, the women's card, said Alexandra Petrie in The Washington Post. This is the golden ticket that entitles lucky women to such rewards as a meager 20% of the Senate and House of Representatives seats, 2 years of catcalls and sexual harassment, until you age and become worthless and invisible to men, and to a lifetime of a sizable discount on your earnings. In politics in particular, holding the woman's card is still a major disadvantage, said Joan Vinoche in the Boston Globe. Women in the public eye are routinely marginalized as too old or too young, too tough or too soft, too ugly or too sexy. Just watch. Clinton's pantsuits and hairstyle will generate more scathing reviews than Trump's paunch and orange comb-over. Prepare for a full-on gender war, said Rachel Liu in NationalReview.com. There's no doubt that Trump, with his decades-long record of calling women dogs and disgusting animals, is a true misogynist. He likes to keep women near him as prizes and playthings, but those who trouble him with aspirations to full-fledged personhood can trigger a vindictive fury. Clinton and her browbeating sisterhood, on the other hand, like to say that women who won't vote for the first female president deserve a special place in hell, and they represent everything that disempowered male Trump supporters detest. When a chauvinist creep faces off with a hard-charging feminist, it's bound to get ugly. McDonald, when is a payoff a payoff? The Supreme Court just might pull Bob McDonald's bacon out of the fire, said the Richmond Times-Dispatch in an editorial. The former Virginia governor and erstwhile rising Republican star made a final effort last week to overturn his 2014 corruption conviction for accepting $177,000 in gifts, loans, vacations, a Rolex watch from businessman Johnny Williams. In return, McDonald helped promote Anabolic, Williams' tobacco-based dietary supplement, by hosting an executive mansion launch party, among other favors. Surprisingly, perhaps, most of the justices seemed sympathetic to McDonald, questioning whether there was an explicit quid pro quo leading to official action. Liberal Stephen Beyer said the corruption statute used in the case was vague and wondered if it criminalizes common political politician-constituent interactions, such as when the quid is a lunch or a baseball ticket. Based on the court's skepticism, McDonald may yet walk. He should, because the gifts Williams gave McDonald were legal, said Scott McKay in AmericanSpectator.org. There was never any real evidence that Williams derived any benefit from the state. No contracts, no payments, and no hint of actual influence being traded. True, McDonald behaved foolishly, and the scandal rightly tarnished his political career. But if arranging some meetings or talking up a product is a felony corruption, how are politicians supposed to serve constituents? Should a state legislator go to prison if he has dinner with someone, then helps steer the person through bureaucratic red tape? How is a city councilman supposed to help with zoning restrictions that don't make sense? We're not talking about a few ham sandwiches, said Zephyr Teachout in the New York Times. Williams gave the governor and his wife a $20,000 shopping spree, $15,000 for a daughter's wedding, and other costly bribes that triggered the governor's actions. Once, for example, McDonald emailed Williams for a $50,000 loan and 6 minutes later sent an email to his staff requesting an update on antibiotic scientific research. If that's not corruption, what is? The court seems to be buying the old everybody does it defense, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com. It would be amazing indeed if in a year when voters are infuriated and sickened by the influence of money in politics, McDonald gets off because he only did what every politician does every day. Take a lot of money to open doors for a rich guy. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.